I don't know if you've heard the story. It might be an urban myth, but I'm choosing to believe that it's a true story of a guy who ended up in a car accident, ended up in hospital, and as part of his recovery, in order to speed his recovery, was asked to wear an oxygen mask. One morning, the nurse was doing the rounds just to check on each of the patients, and she checked in on this particular guy and walked into the room, and he motions at the nurse, you know, beckons to her, and she draws close to the bedside, and he's speaking through the oxygen mask and says to her, "Are my testicles black?" And she goes, "Bright red." Oh, this is hugely embarrassing. And says, okay, I'll just quickly check. Pulls down the covers, whips down his shorts. "No, sir, your testicles, they're completely fine." He looks somewhat frustrated, and she just like swiftly moves out of the room. An hour goes by and she's doing the rounds again. She's like, "Okay, I better go and check on that patient," and walks into the room, and the guy motions to the nurse, speaking through the oxygen mask. "Excuse me, but this time a bit more frustrated. Are my testicles black?" She's like, "Oh gosh, not again." So she whips down the covers, pulls down his shorts. "No, sir, your testicles, they're still just fine. Absolutely fine." And she rushes out, super embarrassed, but can tell that the patient's like even more agitated. A couple of hours go by. She's doing the rounds thinking, "Oh God, not that patient again." Anyway, walks into the room and can see that the guy's super frustrated, and he whips off his oxygen mask and says, "Are my test results back?" Now, I think we can all feel the pain for both the patient and the nurse in that scenario. Some of you will be thinking, what on earth has that got to do with Christmas? And the answer is very little. I think it happened at Christmas. But there's a tenuous link into the rest of my talk, so here it is. The events we've been singing about, events that took place 2,000 years ago, that in their time, these events were earth-shattering, paradigm-shifting, life-changing events. And a message rang out because of these events. And it didn't just ring out in sort of Bethlehem and then spreading to Judea. No, this message rang out right throughout the Roman world. And more than that, over the last 2,000 years, this message has been ringing out. And that's what we're celebrating at Christmas. But particularly in the West, those 2,000 years have slightly diluted the message of the story, slightly distorted the message. So much so, in fact, that according to a piece of research recently done by Barna Research Group, they polled the UK population and found that 40%, almost half of the UK population, believe that Jesus is a mythical figure. So, you know, at Christmas, where we celebrate like Santa Claus, slightly overweight guy with a bushy beard, lives in the North Pole and hangs out with elves and makes toys, and he's old but never gets older. And you hit the age of 6 or 7, you know, when reason kicks in, and you're like, nah, he doesn't actually exist. Sorry to break it to anyone that didn't realize that, but no, he doesn't exist. And then Rudolph, this like reindeer with the red nose who can fly, and he pulls Santa's sleigh. No, he doesn't exist. And this baby Jesus that grew up and walked on water and fed thousands with a bit of bread and then died and rose again. No, he doesn't exist. And they lump Jesus in the same category as, you know, Santa Claus and the reindeer that can fly, and just dismiss Jesus. Yet, you will struggle to find any historian, whether they be Christian or otherwise, that would deny the existence of the historical person of Jesus. More than that, you'll struggle to find any historian who would deny the facts around the events of his birth, his life, and his death. So what we're going to try and do in this talk in the next 20 minutes or so is I want to take off the oxygen mask so we can hear the actual message that rang out that first Christmas. And if I was to summarize it in a sentence, it would be this: there's a way back home. There's a way back home. If I was to ask you, where's home? Don't all shout out at once, because that'd be awkward. But imagine we're in the pub afterwards and I say, look, where's home? The most likely answer you're going to provide is a geographical one, right? And our home for me is Finsbury Park. Or, you know, I live in Bethnal Green. Or actually, I live just up the Cali Road, you know, 18 Caledonian Road. I don't live there, by the way, so don't bother coming around afterwards. You'll meet some strange person. But you're going to give some sort of like place name, right? But if I push you a bit further and said, like, well, imagine you lost that house. Like, where do you feel most at home? Most at ease in your own skin. At that point, most people move beyond places and begin to name people. I'm most at home in the presence of ... like my mum and dad, my husband, my wife, these incredible friends. I'm most at home in this community. So we move from places and we begin to talk about people. But if I pushed you further and dug a little deeper, most people then move on from places, move on from people, and begin to talk about state of the heart, state of the mind. Like for me, home would be a life without anxiety and without these insecurities that I have. And it would be being part of a community where I know that I'm loved and I can love in return. And it would be like waking up with a sense of purpose and finding fulfillment in my job and having hope for the future. I guess home would be being fully, fully alive, flourishing in every way possible. And if we define home like that, we'd have to acknowledge that none of us live there, right? Like we may visit there every so often, but none of us live at home. Like if you're anything like me, every so often I have like insecure thoughts and I wake up with anxiety and I love my job, but sometimes I feel unfulfilled and I have these longings of like, I want to live there. And questions emerge like, does there exist? Can you even get there, home, this vision of human flourishing? And most in the room would have some sort of answer to that question. Even if it was inadequate, you'd have some sort of answer. And your answer would depend on your worldview. Now, sociologists tell us that a worldview is essentially a lens through which you see and make sense of the world around you. And your worldview is shaped by your upbringing, your education, your family and friends, by painful experiences that you go through and great experiences. It all comes together to form this worldview. And sociologists tell us that worldviews help us answer these four core questions. Where are we? Who are we? What's wrong with the world? And what's the remedy? And worldviews nearly always come in the form of a story, whether it's a religious worldview, a political worldview, an ideological worldview. And the story looks something like this. There's a beginning of the story, like a creation. And that might be the Big Bang, the theory of evolution, the story of the Garden of Eden. Then there'll be an account of earthly pain, like how we ended up in this mess with so much human suffering and poverty and injustice and violence around us. And then it will move on to try and provide a remedy of here's how we move from this current place of pain towards some sort of like utopian vision. Let's call that heaven on earth. And forget this understanding of heaven being like up there. Like if you keep on going beyond the clouds, beyond the stars, like beyond the different stratospheres, and eventually you find God chilling out with angels. Like forget that understanding of heaven. Think of heaven as like flourishing here on earth. Most worldviews have a vision of how we can journey towards this vision of human flourishing. And my hunch is that in a room like this, there'll be two particular worldviews that dominate, depending on how old you are. So for the slightly older crowd, I won't name the age, don't worry. But for the slightly older crowd, you grew up with a worldview of modernity, the Enlightenment. And the remedy that was provided by the Enlightenment was essentially, like, if we can have some serious scientific breakthroughs and technological advance, then we can just march on. We can progress towards this utopian vision. We can control our surroundings. One of the key catchphrases of the modern mind is, we can become masters of our own destiny. Very Star Wars-esque. You know, we'll control our surroundings and create this pathway to human flourishing. But around the 1950s, sociologists started to tell us that modernity was dead and the Enlightenment project had failed and we were giving up on it. So why? And the short answer is two world wars and the Holocaust and some of the horrible injustices of the first half of the 20th century. And at that moment, people began to question modernity and it's like, well, has it really worked? Like, yes, we've had some scientific breakthroughs. We've split the atom. Like, we've invented the bomb, but we've used it to create so much pain. And maybe the problem isn't out there that we can control through science. What if the problem's in here? And not just in the heart of Hitler or today members of ISIS or whoever else, but maybe it's in each of us, like, on my good days, I'm pretty good, by the way. I think you'd quite like me most of the time. But on my bad days, like, there's pride and, like, selfishness and greed. And I get angry and my hunches, you do too. And, you know, in certain circumstances, if that stuff was allowed to grow, I could do some pretty ropey stuff. So people decided, like, modernity isn't working. We need something post-modernity. You can see where I'm going. We need post-modernity. So the younger amongst you grew up with the worldview of post-modernity, and post-modernity essentially said we need to get rid of these overarching narratives because they just try and control people. We need to get rid of this idea that there's such a thing as absolute truth. There isn't. Truth is relative. So you can have your truth, and you can have your truth, and you can have your truth. I'll have my truth. And as long as we get along nicely and tolerate one another's views, then we can march on towards this utopian vision. And in the last 5 years or so, sociologists have told us that postmodernism's dead. Some would argue that it's dying, still limping on, but most would say it's dead. So why did it die? Three quick reasons that come to mind for me. Number one, very pragmatically, it didn't work. There was still a huge amount of poverty and injustice and inequality, and people like, this isn't actually working, getting rid of these overarching narratives. Second reason is the philosophers got on board and said, look, it's philosophically flawed, this way of thinking. So Roger Scruton, a professor from Oxford University, said this. He said, if anyone tells you there's no such thing as absolute truth, they're asking you not to believe them, so don't. And he's highlighting the major flaw of postmodern thinking, that relativity relativizes itself. The statement, there can be no such thing as absolute truth, is a statement claiming absolute truth, and therefore it cannot be true. It's a circular argument. Here's the third reason why we rejected postmodernism, because let's face it, most of us aren't philosophers, are we? We're just like regular people trying to get by in life and have some fun. Most of us gave up on postmodernity. Because if you take away these overarching narratives in which we find meaning and belonging and purpose and hope, if you take that away, what are you left with? And the answer is nothing. And most people prefer something to nothing. So what's coming next? We've had modernity, we've had postmodernity. Like, what's coming next? And that's beyond my pay grade. I honestly don't know. But I do know this. There was a voice ringing out from 2,000 years ago, and it continued ringing out through modernity. And it kept on ringing through postmodernity. And whatever comes next, it will carry on ringing. I want to tell you a story of a cellist. I'm known as the cellist of Sarajevo, Vedran Smelovic. And he became well known in the 90s. He was one of the lead players in the Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra. An incredible musician. And at that time, Sarajevo was under siege. And bombs were constantly dropping from the sky. And gunshots were always heard throughout the city. And the more bombs, the more this place became like a pile of rubble, this beautiful city, like destroyed day by day. And on one particular day, 26th of May 1992, Smelovic was rehearsing in his room where he always practiced, and a bomb went off right outside his room where he was practicing, and it shook the room and it shook him up. And he put his cello to one side and ran to the window, and outside the window could see a scene of rubble and 22 dead bodies lying on the ground. These 22 people had been queuing up in the bread queue just trying to get some food to get through that day, and their lives were taken just like that. And he was traumatized by what he saw and woke up the next day and was just like, I can't do nothing. I've got to do something. What can I do? So he did do something, and it was an act of defiance. So 4 o'clock that afternoon, the same time that the bomb had gone off the day before, Smelovic dressed up in his tails and he got his cello and he walked outside the room where he would practice. And in the midst of the rubble, he began to play a piece of music, known as the Adagio in G minor. And for the next 22 days, every day at 4 p.m., he'd dress up in his tails and he'd take his cello out to the streets and just start playing. And he was wanting to honor the lives of 22 people that had been taken. So it was an act of defiance, but more than that, he was scattering seeds of hope. Like, and it stirred up this longing. People started to see the music as like a music that was coming from somewhere else, like a distant land, another country, a world in which there wasn't any death, any grief, any crying, any pain. And the people of Sarajevo would listen to the music and think, I want to go there. Don't want to embrace the trauma and the pain of this place. I want to go there, or more than that, I want there to come here. I want this place to be restored to its former glory. And those questions of like, does there even exist? And if it does, like, how do we get there? Those questions became longings, and they just grew and grew and grew. You can fade out the music now. Thanks, Skip. Beautiful music though, eh? Ooh, had a moment. C.S. Lewis spoke about this distant country, this far-off land, that we can almost hear the music from this home. And he said this about it. He said, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that doesn't mean that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. In the next 5 minutes, I'm going to try and do this briefly, so I'm going to talk super fast because that's normally how it rolls here at KXC. I want to look at the biblical narrative and look at what the narrative says about this theme of home. Does it exist? Can we get there? So the biblical narrative starts in a garden, the Garden of Eden, and some of you will be inwardly chuckling. You're super polite, because otherwise you'd be chuckling out loud. And you'd be basically thinking, like, do these guys actually believe in Genesis 1, 2, and 3? And partly you think that because modernism told you to reject supernaturalism, you know, and Genesis 1, 2, 3 is lousy science. So you're thinking, it's lousy science. Do they actually believe it? And to those inwardly chuckling, I'd say this. I agree. It's lousy science. Like, it's super embarrassing. That's the point of Genesis 1, 2, and 3. It isn't science. It isn't science. It was written around the 5th or 6th century BC when the Jewish people were in Babylon. In other words, hundreds of years before the genre of science came about. Actually, hundreds of years before the genre of philosophy came about with the Greeks. So before you had science and before you had philosophy in the ancient world, you had something called mythology. Now, empty your mind of how we use this term myth. It's a story that isn't true. In the ancient world, a myth was a story of beginnings that was loaded with truths, but without any of the constraints of historical or scientific ways of knowing. So the question we should be asking is, what are the loaded truths within this story? And this would be the primary like truth contained in the story, that God, out of the overflow of his love, creates this beautiful world and this beautiful garden. Paradise, as Coldplay would sing. And he creates humanity to live in this garden and to live life fully. Like, God is the creator, the source of life. And he basically says, if you're in relationship with me, life will flow from me to you and you will be fully alive. No sin, no sickness, no suffering in the garden. Humanity flourishing in every way possible. That's the point of Genesis 1 and 2. But then Genesis 3 kicks in, the story of the serpent that begins to speak to Adam and Eve, and they take a bite from this fruit. And some of you are like chuckling again inwardly, like, oh my goodness, like, snakes don't talk. Like, this is crazy. They don't crawl, they slither. It's mythology. This isn't science, because it would be lousy science. This is mythology. So what's the truth contained in this part of the story? And it has to do with sin. And sin is best defined as selfishness. Martin Luther, the brilliant Reformation theologian, defined sin as a life turned in on itself. And I think we can all relate to that. In other words, a life where your dreams, your desires, your longings, your needs, your goals, your ambitions, that's all that really matters. It's all about you. Look after number one, and our culture celebrates that way of thinking. You're entitled to it. If it feels good, do it. And if you multiply that mindset by like almost 8 billion people on the planet, of course there's going to be human suffering and horrific injustice, as people use and abuse other people to get by in life. So you have this story of humanity basically being thrown out of the garden because the serpent said, like, why didn't you choose life revolved around yourself? Like, you don't have to live in God's garden, even though you're fully alive in that garden. You can create your own garden where you will be God, you will be king, and everything revolves around you. And Adam and Eve said, yeah, that sounds cool. Let's do that. So they end up outside of the garden in the wilderness, and they spend the next chunk of time trying to create a garden centered around themselves in which they can flourish. And the more they tried to create this utopian style of life, the more pain and suffering came about. And most of the first half of the Bible, which is called the Old Testament, is the story of the nation of Israel trying to get home to the Garden of Eden, trying to get back into relationship with God where they can flourish and live life fully. And in the middle of this story, we have the events we've been singing about. This little baby's born. Like, the angel comes to Mary and says, look, I know you're a virgin and you're not married yet, but you're going to have a child. Don't worry, it's going to be conceived of the Holy Spirit. And he's going to be the savior of the world. Joseph is going to freak out, so you should probably explain all these events to him. I'm paraphrasing the story, obviously. But all of these things happen, and they have the baby, and they lay him in a manger, and they give the baby a name. And names matter, right? They certainly did in the ancient world, and they named this baby Jesus. The Aramaic name is Yahshua. Literally means Yahweh, which is a name for God. God saves. And the root word of Yahshua is Yasha. It's the Hebrew term for salvation, which is best defined as to be led to a wide open space. That's how the Jewish people understand salvation. To be led to a wide open space where you're free, you can live life fully. Which sounds a lot like Eden, right? So they name this baby, God will lead you to a wide open space. And this baby grew up and became a man. And what did Jesus spend most of his time doing? And the answer is leading people to the wide open space. He healed the sick. The eyes of the blind were open. The ears of the deaf unblocked. And lame people started walking. And those struggling with leprosy were cleansed and healed. And those on the margins of society, the tax collectors, you know, the prostitutes, the adulterers, they were all drawn into this community. And it's as if Jesus kept knocking through doors and saying, come and live in the wide open space. Come and live the lives you were meant to live. Let me tell you about the end of the story very briefly, the end of the Christian story, because some people have this idea that the end of the Christian story is we leave our bodies behind when we die and our souls ascend to this sort of like disembodied bliss where we chill out with the angels drinking Red Bull and playing harps, which sounds fun, right? I mean, I'd quite enjoy that. The problem is that it just has nothing to do with the New Testament, nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus or Paul or any other writers of the New Testament. The New Testament ends like this, not us ascending to some sort of disembodied bliss. Instead, like heaven comes down. God comes down and makes his dwelling place with humanity once more. And we're told when this happens, when heaven comes down, you know, there'll be no death, no grief, no crying, no pain. In other words, it sounds a lot like Eden, where there was no sin, no sickness, no suffering, humanity fully alive. And then God in Revelation 21 is described as beginning to sit down, which is indicative of his work being complete. And he says these amazing words. He says, behold, I'm making all things new. Now, in the Greek language, you've got two words for new, and the New Testament was written mainly in Greek. You've got neos, which means brand new, and you've got kainos, which is something old that's made new. It's restored to its former glory. And so when God sits down on his throne, he says, behold, I'm making all things kainos. Not I'm going to create a new place and your soul can ascend to this disembodied bliss. No, I'm going to restore everything here so humanity can flourish in relationship with me. That's the end of the Christian story. God coming down, heaven coming down, all things being restored. It beats drinking Red Bull with the angels, I think. So why do we celebrate these events? Why do we sing all these amazing carols? What's so special about Christmas? And the short answer is Christmas is the beginning of the end of the Christian story. Right at the very end, God comes down, heaven comes down. Essentially, that's what begins to happen in the birth of Jesus. God wraps himself in human flesh, enters the earthly pain, the mess. He's born out of wedlock, so, you know, huge shame surrounding that. He's born into poverty in this disgusting stable. He lives most of his life in poverty, and he dies this brutal death, and then eventually rises to new life to kick open this door so that we can live in the wide open space we were made for. That's what the Christmas message is essentially about. I want to come into land with another story of a British family that went on holiday in Mallorca. And they rented this villa, and at the back of the villa there's this beautiful garden. At the end of the garden there was like a brick wall with a gate in it. And as you went through the gate, you went down these rocky steps, and it was like a private beach. And this family were just loving this villa, enjoying their holiday. And then on one day, the seven-year-old son, the youngest son, was playing in the garden. And he went to the back of the garden. He opened up the gate and he was just watching the tide come in. And as it climbed up the steps, and then a rogue wave came and knocked the seven-year-old and swept him out to sea. And the only one that saw this was the dad. And the dad did what anyone in this room would do, let alone any loving father would do, like ran to the bottom of the garden to look for his son. And his son was being swept out to sea, so he just jumped into the sea after his son. But the tragedy in this story was that the dad didn't know how to swim. He'd never been taught how to swim. So he sees his seven-year-old drifting out to sea, and he's like, I've got to do something, and just jumps in. And I don't know what the dad would have been thinking. Maybe he was thinking, at best, I'll grab my son and I'll try and get him back to safety. At worst, I'm just going to hold him during the final moments of his life. And tragically, father and son drowned together. And in 2012, when this took place, the UK press got hold of the story and obviously honored this act of incredible bravery of the dad. And I remember reading this story, being shaken by it, partly because my eldest son, we've got three kids, my eldest son is like turning seven. Just like, I just can't even imagine the pain and the suffering of that event. And then as I thought about it more, I kind of thought, well, do you know what? Maybe that story, even if inadequately, points towards the Christmas story. And that's why Christians celebrate Christmas so wholeheartedly, because it points to the God that we worship. This Father that would do anything to rescue his kids. So what does God do? He wraps himself in human flesh in the person of Jesus, and he jumps into the waters to rescue us, so that we could experience fullness of life. And that's why it's tragic that 40% of the UK population believe Jesus is essentially Luke Skywalker that happens to love sheep, or some slightly odd internet nerd with a halo. That Jesus totally freaks me out. And most people in the UK just think of Jesus like that, and they don't realize that Jesus would have been a lot more like this. That he was a real person. That when his friends rejected him, it hurt like hell, like it would for you. And when he got beaten and whipped and flogged, it hurt like hell. And when they nailed him to a cross, it hurt like hell. And he died, and 3 days later he rose again to kick open this door to the wide open space. And this is the Jesus we've been singing about. I want to land with a poem from John Betjeman, brilliant poet. And he wrote this poem. It's called Advent 1955, but 60 years later, not much has changed. And he's basically encouraging us to take off the oxygen mask so we can hear the actual message of Christmas, because there's so many distractions all around us, even more so now in 2015 as opposed to 1955. But this is what John Betjeman says. We raise the price of things in shops. We give plain boxes fancy tops and lines which traders cannot sell. Thus parceled go extremely well. We dole out bribes we call a present to those to whom we must be pleasant for business reasons. Our defense is these bribes are charged against expenses and bring relief in income tax. Enough of these unworthy cracks. The time draws near the birth of Christ, a present that cannot be priced. Given 2,000 years ago, yet if God had not given so, he still would be a distant stranger. And not the baby in a manger. So my prayer for you this Christmas, and my prayer for me, and if I'm honest, I'll mainly be praying for me because I'm pretty selfish. My prayer will be this, that as you open up the presents and you just tear away the paper, it's like, oh, that box set, awesome. Oh, those socks that I didn't ask for and don't really want. And that tangerine, that's always helpful in the stocking. As you open up all these presents, you'd be aware that there's a far greater present on offer. And that present comes in the form of a person. And that person has a name. And his name is Jesus. And his mates would have called him Yahshua. God will lead you, if you let him. God will lead you to a wide open space.